Tonight, it's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Susan Hornstein, who is actually, I guess, on her second career. Would that be fair to say that? She has a PhD in cognitive psychology from Brown University, worked in websites, designing websites, UI experience. I know UI, UX, as we were just talking about it. Now she is in the Smicha program, fourth year Smicha at Yeshivat Maharat. Grew up in Boca Raton and lives in Highland Park. And we're glad to hear that her son and son-in-law are back after having served in the current war in Israel. And Baruch Hashem, we should hope all our soldiers should be well, and the hostages mm-hmm. should please God come back. And the pleasure to welcome her back. And today's shiur is actually being sponsored by Kenny Wintman in memory of Dr. Hornstein's mother, Diane Markovitz, Sarah Dvorah Bat Chaim Yishayahu, Bechana Rachel, whose 38th yahrzeit was a week ago on Gimel Shvat. You should have long life and happy occasions to come together. Bakasha, Susan, let's get started.
Excellent. Thank you. I want to thank Kenny Wintman, one of my biggest supporters, my pseudo brother, for sponsoring the shiur. I also would like to thank Rabbanit Leah Sarna, who gave a shiur several years ago about Yosef that I have never been able to get out of my head, and which inspired me to do the work that led to this shiur today. So Hanukkah is over, and for some of us, winter break has just ended. So can Pesach be far behind? At the same time, you're supposed to laugh. Everybody's supposed to laugh, but you're all on mute. So there you go. At the same time, the fall and winter readings of Sefer Bereishit are coming to an end, and we're transitioning into the Pesach-oriented parashot of Sefer Shemot. This is a big transition. We leave Bereishit with the choosing up process complete. It's been sort of a tournament with a lot of elimination levels of seeing who gets to be the continuation of the Jewish people. We start the elimination all the way back with Cain and Hevel, and Lot, Yitzchak and Yishmael, Yaakov and Esav, and now we've kind of gotten to the finals. Who is going to constitute the Jewish people? Just when you thought there was one more round, we finally said, you're all winners. All 12 sons of Yaakov get to constitute the Jewish people. We're not choosing one over the others. And even though they've gone to Egypt to live, they're doing pretty well. They're prospering and multiplying. And then, suddenly, at the end of this week's Parsha, next week, we're in Shemot, and Bnei Yisrael are enslaved. So the question is, how did that happen? We went from doing pretty well to oppression and slavery. And there has to be a process of that happening, and that's what I'd like to look at. So to try to understand this, we really need to go all the way back to Avraham and the covenant that God made with Avraham back in chapter 15 of Bereishit. This is source one on the sheets, and I can try to share my screen with the source sheet. How's that? Can you see just the source sheet? Okay, great. So we're going to go back to...
I would make it slightly bigger if you can, I think. I mean, I can read it, but I think if you can just enlarge it a little bit, and don't ask me how to do that, but...
let's see if I can figure out how to do that.
Yeah, there you go.
You can just make it wider so you can actually see it.
Right.
Okay. So we're going to go back all the way to Brit Bein HaBetarim just to see where this whole process started. Wait a minute. And that is source one on your sheets. It's Brit Bein HaBetarim is actually fairly long, but the part that is most interesting for this is when it says, Vayomer la'avram yadoa teda ki ger yihiyeh zaracha be'eretz lo lahem. Va'avadum ve'inu otam arba me'ot shana. God said to Avraham, know well, and that's what I'm trying to move this thing over, know well that your offspring shall be strangers in a land not theirs, and they shall be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. It seems that affliction, strangerhood, and servitude, or inui, Geirut, and Avdut are prerequisites to being God's nation, and somehow to being the kind of nation that God wants us to be. Now, it would be easy to philosophize about this and say that we have to know hardship to learn to be kind, that we have to know servitude to learn to serve Hashem and all of that. But we also can't forget that real people suffered real hardships as a result of these afflictions. It feels like kind of a tough way to learn the lesson of how to be a good people. But clearly this is God's plan. And of course, those things are played out at the beginning of the book of Shemot, which we'll read next week, where they are afflicted and they're strangers and they are slaves. But now we really have to figure out how we get there. We're not just having a good time in Bereshit and then suddenly enslaved in Shemot. And even though it's all God's plan, it's interesting to look at the course of events that end with the enslavement and affliction of Bnei Israel in this land that's not theirs. So we're going to look at two sets of people. We're going to look at what's happening with Bnei Israel at the end of Bereshit and what's happening with the Egyptian people at the end of Bereshit. And then we'll move on to Shemot and see where we've wound up. So first of all, we're going to see with what's happening with the Bnei Israel. So fasten your seatbelts. I'm going to do the 1 minute recap of Jacob and his sons to just get us up to date of where we are. Jacob marries his cousin Laban's two daughters, Leah and Rachel, plus their two maidservants, her Bilhah and Zilpah, and has 12 sons, one daughter. Leaves Laban, goes back to the land of Canaan. Rachel dies while giving birth to Binyamin when they're almost home. Yosef, Rachel's older son, is Yaakov's favorite, gives him a special coat. Yosef has dreams of ruling over his brothers, and perhaps unwisely, tells these dreams to the brothers. They decide to do away with him, but instead, they sell him into Egyptian slavery and tell Yaakov he's dead. Yaakov is despondent. Yosef has some adventures in Egypt, including interpreting the dreams of some servants of Paro. Then Paro has dreams of 7 fat cows, 7 skinny cows, 7 healthy sheaves, 7 sickly sheaves. They call Yosef to interpret the dreams. He interprets them and attributes his interpretations to God. He predicts 7 years of plenty, during which food should be collected, following by 7 years of famine, during which the Egyptians would not starve because of the surplus food collected during the years of plenty. Paro puts Yosef in charge of this, and it all comes true. Famine reaches Canaan. The brothers come to Egypt for food. And of course, it's Yosef who's in charge. Suddenly his dreams are fulfilled and they're bowing down to him. He messes with them for several chapters and finally reveals himself to them. Everyone agrees that Yaakov and the whole fam should come to Egypt where Yosef can take care of them. Okay, phew. Everyone is happy about Yosef and his family coming to Egypt. And this is source 2 on the sheet. It says, the news reached Paro's palace. Joseph's brothers have come. Paro and his courtiers were pleased. Paro said to Yosef, say to your brothers, do this. Load up your beasts. Go to Canaan. Take your father, your households, come to me. I will give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you shall live off the fat of the land. That was back in chapter 45 of Bereshit. So this all takes place 2 years into the 7 years of famine. There are still 5 years to go, and Yosef is positioned to save his family to ensure the survival of the nascent Jewish people. We'll see a bit more about what happens during the rest of the famine when we look at the Egyptians. But for now, Yosef's brothers and Yaakov are living in the choicest region, Goshen. They have food, and everything's going well. 17 years pass, and Yaakov is quite old and has had quite an eventful life. His life is coming to an end, and we read his deathbed scenes, and that brings us to this week's Parsha of Parsha Vayechi. Now, remember that the last deathbed scene that we remember was when Yitzchak died, and he asks for his favorite son, Esav, to come bring him a meal so that he can give him a blessing. Drama ensues, and Yaakov, the younger son, gets the blessing and the legacy. So now let's take a look at the first of Yaakov's 3 deathbed scenes. Yes, there are 3 deathbed scenes in this parsha, and that scene is source 3 on your sheet. We are in Bereshit chapter 47, verses 28 to 31. Yaakov lived 17 years in the land of Egypt, so then he was 147 years old. And when the time approached for Yisrael, which is the same as Yaakov, to die, he summoned his son Yosef and said to him, Do me this favor. Place your hand under my thigh. As a pledge of your steadfast loyalty, please do not bury me in Egypt. When I lie down with my ancestors, take me up from Egypt and bury me in their burial place. He, Yosef, replied, I will do as you have spoken. And he said, swear to me. And he swore to him. Then Yisrael bowed at the head of the bed. So what do we have? Dying patriarch summons his favorite son, not the firstborn, for a deathbed talk. But this interaction is not so typical. Yaakov simply asks Yosef to bury him in Canaan. Now, Rashi actually points out that this was not so much a thing you would ask your favorite son, but it was a kind of a thing to ask somebody who had the power to go do something like that. So in asking Yosef to bury him in Canaan, he's actually asking the son who could actually make that happen, whether he's his favorite or not. He's the one with the power. End scene. So this actually sounds a lot more like, you know, cemetery pre-need planning, when you pay your funeral expenses in advance, much more than a deathbed scene. But it is framed as Yaakov is getting ready to die. But that's the end of the scene. But Yaakov fails to die at the end of this deathbed scene, and we end up with deathbed scene number 2, which is going to be source number 4. He does another summoning to his deathbed. Well, actually, not quite a summoning. Yosef comes voluntarily. In this scene, I'm not going to read the whole entire thing, but it starts off sometime afterward. It's right after that last scene in the Torah. Yosef was told, your father is ill. So he takes Menashe and Avraham to see his father, Yaakov. And Yaakov looks at Yosef and the boys, and he says to Yosef, now your two sons, this is verse 5, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, shall be mine. Ephraim and Menashe shall be mine no less than Reuven and Shimon. And he goes back and talks about Rachel's death and Yosef's birth. And then he says, you know, who are these? And Yosef says, these are my sons. Yaakov says, bring them up to me so that I can bless them. And Yaakov couldn't really see very much anymore, and Yosef brings the boys there, and Yaakov kisses them and embraces them, and says something that I actually find extremely poignant. Yaakov says to Yosef, Israel says to Yosef, I never expected to see you again, and here God has let me see your children as well. I think that's really beautiful. And so Yosef takes Ephraim with his right hand to put him on Yaakov's left side, and Menashe with his left hand to Yisrael's right side, and brought them close to him. But Yaakov, Yisrael, stretches out his right hand and lays it on Ephraim's head, though he was the younger, and his left hand on Menashe's head, thus crossing his hands, although Menashe was the firstborn. And then he gives them a blessing. He blesses Yosef first, and he's blessing Yosef with land and offspring, the same covenantal blessing that he got. And he blesses the children. He blesses Yosef for his children. He says the famous line, Hamalach ha-goeloti mikol ra, yivarech et ha-ne'arim v'yikarei bahem shemi, b'shem avotai, Avraham v'yitzchak, v'yidgu la-rov b'kerev ha-aretz. The God in whose ways my fathers Avraham and Yitzchak walked, the God who has been my shepherd from my birth to this day, the messenger who has redeemed me from all harm, may that God bless the lads. And in them may my name be recalled, and the names of my fathers, Avraham and Yitzchak, may they be teeming multitudes upon the earth. Then Yosef tries to correct him and says, nope, that one's older and that one's younger. You've got your hands wrong. And Yaakov, in verse 19, says, I know, my son, I know. He too shall become a people, and he too shall be great. Yet his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his offspring shall be plentiful enough for nations. So he blessed them that day, saying, by you shall Israel invoke blessings, saying, Yisimcha Elohim ke Ephraim v'chi Menashe. Thus he put Ephraim before Menashe. This time, Yosef came voluntarily and brings his two sons with him. Yaakov proclaims that the two sons are his, much as Reuven and Shimon. And then we have another familiar scene, like a familiar trope in the Torah, the switching of the firstborn son with the secondborn son, repeating a pattern that started long ago. Yaakov blesses Yosef with the legacy of the land of Canaan and blesses both Ephraim and Manasseh. Ephraim with the legacy of being a great nation, and Manasseh that he will be a nation too. So right now, it sounds like we're going to follow the pattern that we've seen earlier in Bereishit. Patriarch picks the favorite non-firstborn son to carry on the legacy. Here, it's sort of two generations in one. First, Yosef, the not firstborn, is the favorite. Then his not firstborn gets picked to be the next patriarch. And then he assures that the other son is also going to be a nation. Sounds just like Yaakov and Esav. Sounds just like Yitzchak and Yishmael. The other one is going to still be a nation, but this is the one that I've picked. It seems that the Jewish people might actually be carried on through Ephraim, the younger son of Yosef. And in fact, Yehoshua, the future leader of Israel, is from the tribe of Ephraim. And that we see that Manasseh is going to give birth to a different, but also powerful nation, just like all the other times in the Torah. End scene. Then, we have a third deathbed scene, at the end of which, Yaakov actually does die. And this time, Yaakov is going to call all of his sons. Each one of them gets a blessing, or at least, as the JPS translation we find in Sepharia calls it, parting words. They don't really actually all sound very blessing-y. They are actually descriptions of the actions and the characteristics of the brother. This is source 5 in your source sheets, and I am not going to read the whole thing because it's pretty long. He calls the sons, he says, come together that I may tell you what is to befall you in the days to come. And each one of the sons gets a statement about him. About Reuven, he says, you're my firstborn, my might, the first fruit of my vigor. Unstable as water, you mounted your father's bed, he slept with his father's concubine. You brought disgrace. Shimon and Levi, their weapons are tools of lawlessness. These don't actually sound much like brachot, but they are statements about them and their legacy. Shimon and Levi have to be separated because they have such a potential for violence. Yehuda is going to be a leader. That is in verse 10. And he is, Yosef has enemies, he says, and is the Nazir Echav, the elect of his brothers, as the dreams predicted. But these blessings, as they were, do not portray the brothers as heroic or particularly meritorious. But what's most interesting about it, I think, is the very last verse, which I've now put onto the screen and is underlined. It says, Kol Eile Shivtei Yisrael, Shneim Asar Vezot Asher Diber Lahem Avihem Vivarech Otam Ish Asher Kevirkato Berach Otam. All of these were the Shivtei Yisrael, the tribes of Israel, 12 in number. And this is what their father said to them as he bade them farewell, addressing to each an appropriate parting word. So the first thing that I would notice about all of this is that we have a radical departure from every previous story in the Torah, including deathbed scene number 2. Here, instead of choosing one son over another son, all of the sons of Yisrael are included. There's no choosing. We're not picking one son to keep on being the Jewish nation and leaving the other son or sons to start other nations. We're also not picking Ephraim over Manasseh. They're not even mentioned in here at all. You know, Reuven and Shimon and all of those as are the actual sons of Yaakov, and they're the ones who are receiving blessings here, even though he's just finished telling us that Ephraim and Manasseh are going to be just as much his sons as his actual born sons. The second thing I notice about this is that I don't actually know the word Shivtei, as in Shivtei Yisrael. We always translate it as the tribes of Israel. But this is only the second use in the whole Torah of the word Shevet. So we don't have a whole lot of precedent for what it means. The first use is 18 verses earlier in the blessing to Yehuda in verse 10. I'm going to scroll back up in the source sheet so that you can see it. And it is underlined now on your screen. Says there in chapter 49, verse 10, Lo yasur shevet me Yehuda. The scepter, or shevet, will not depart from Yehuda, Umechokek mi ben raglav, ad ki yavo shilo, velo yikat amim. The shevet, the scepter, shall not depart from Yehuda, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, so that tribute shall come to him, and the homage of peoples be his. So in verse 10, in the blessing of Yehuda, the word shevet means a scepter or a staff, the sign of a ruler. Now, this could be a prefiguring of the idea of the Davidic line, which is going to come later on and be descended from the tribe of Yehuda. He is the father of kings. In our last pasuk in the whole thing, which I'll now scroll back down to again, we have the word Shivtei Yisrael, and we translate it as tribes. This is the first time that one nation has actually had tribes inside that nation, subdivisions of the nation. We know, though, that the first usage of the word is the one that establishes a word's base meaning. We know that because we've been coming to Torah in Motion and listening to Rabbi Liebtag for long enough. And he always wants to tell us that we have to go back and look at the first meaning, the first words, the first occurrence of the word in the Torah. So this word's first occurrence is where it means scepter or staff, the sign of a ruler. So here, where it means tribes, those tribes have to have something to do with ruling. It sounds like they're going to be tribes, and each one of them is going to have its own ruler while still being part of a larger nation. It's a nation with subdivisions. It's a large, well-organized, well, you know, hierarchically ruled nation. This is brand new. It's new for us. We've always had single-family nations, and maybe it's even new in the whole area around them. It's a nation with 12 birth lines. That is a lot of potential power. And that is who is living in the land that is not their own, in the land of Goshen, in suburban Egypt, as we transition into Sefer Shemot. There's one more thing I did notice about all of this. Yosef does get a blessing among his brothers and is called one of the Shivtei Yisrael. But as we go forward, Yosef doesn't actually get a tribe. His children, Ephraim and Manasseh, who didn't get blessings in this list, they become the tribes. There still are 12 because at that point we're not going to count Levi as their own tribe because they're not going to get a nachala. They're not going to get an inherited portion of the land. But the sons of Ephraim, his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, are the ones after whom the tribes are named. So just file that in the back of your mind because we're going to come back to that thought in a little while. I could stop for a moment and see if there are questions up until this point. How about that?
Very clear. No questions.
Okay. All right. I think we should find out now what's up with the Egyptians as we end Sefer Bereishit. For that, we're going to need to go back to last week's Parsha, Parshat Vayigash. Remember that Yosef's brothers arrived in the second year of the famine with 5 years to go. So before I re-share anything, I want to imagine what the food system that Yosef is in charge of could have looked like. In the 7 years of plenty, Yosef gathers all of the surplus food, which is described in chapter 41, which is not on your source sheets anyway. It says, Vayikvotz et kol ochel sheva shanim, asher hayu be'eretz Mitzrayim. He gathered all the grain of the 7 years, well, all of it that they weren't eating, all the surplus grain of the 7 years that Egypt was enjoying, and he stored the grain in the cities, and he put in each city the grain of the fields around it. And it says, Vayitzbor Yosef bar kechol hayam, harbe ma'od. Joseph collected produce in very large quantity, like the sands of the sea, until he ceased to measure it, for it could not be measured. There was a lot of extra food, and they were going to need it, so Yosef was in charge of collecting it and saving it up. What could he have done to design a system that would be needed to distribute this food in the years of the famine? Anybody have any suggestions? What kind of a system could he have instituted at that point? Could have had, okay, yes?
Could give it away.
He could give it away. He could have had a purely socialist system where everybody gets what they need when they need it. They give what they have when they have it, and they get what they need when they need it. He didn't have to just give it away. He could have had some other sort of a system too. Any other ideas?
Could have kept a record of what who gave what,
Yes,
and then give it
kept
back
the
to them
record of
in
how
that
much you
amount.
gave in, and then when you need it later, you have credits that you can draw on later on to cash in your chits from when you turned in your. He could have kept records of the size of each family and doled out the food based on the number of people in your household. He could have done all of those things.
He could have done something else. He could have told each family to gather their own.
That's right. He didn't have to store it centrally. He could have had, he could have helped everybody build a silo, and he could have had everybody store their own food so that when the time came, they would have the food left over surplus to eat during the time of famine.
He could have also shared the knowledge with the surrounding nations and asked them to start storing food.
That might have been helpful too. And nobody would have had to come along.
What about when he had the food, he would divvy out half of it, whatever, and then after the famine, they get the rest of it.
Yep. He could have apportioned it in different ways. Absolutely. So could have had a voucher system, ration cards, all of that. Nope. That is not what Yosef did. So now we can look at source number 6, and I will share again, I think. Wait a minute. Share. Preview. Okay. Source number 6. How the Egyptians are stripped of their land. We are now in chapter 47, verses 13 to 24. Now there was no bread in all the world. I gotta make it wider for you guys. For the famine was very severe. Both the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. Joseph gathered in all the money that was to be found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan as payment for the rations that were being procured. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's palace. He didn't do any of those things that we just said. He made everybody pay for the food that they had given him during the years of plenty. At a time when they had no income, he made them all pay for the food. And in verse 15, when the money gave out in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Yosef and said, "Give us bread, lest we die before your very eyes, for the money is gone." And Yosef said, didn't say, "Oh, sure, fine, here's some food." He said, "Bring your livestock, and I will sell it to you against your livestock if the money is gone." So they brought their livestock to Yosef, and Yosef gave them bread in exchange for the horses, for the stocks of sheep and cattle and the asses. Thus, he provided them with bread that year in exchange for all their livestock. Now they had to sell him their animals, which may have been their only remaining source of income. Now we're in verse 18. And when that year was ended, they came to him and said, "We cannot hide from my lord that with all the money and animal stocks consigned to my lord, nothing is left at my lord's disposal save our persons and our farmland. Let us not perish before your eyes, both we and our land. Take us and our land in exchange for bread, and we with our land will be serfs to Paro, avadim lefaro. Provide the seed that we may live and not die, that the land may not become a waste." Serfs is a pretty word for slaves. They were becoming avadim lefaro, all the Egyptian people. Now listen carefully. He takes all of their land. Yosef gained possession of all the farmland of Egypt for Pharaoh, all the Egyptians having sold their fields because the famine was too much for them. Thus the land passed over to Pharaoh, and he removed the population town by town from one end of Egypt's border to the other. Only the land of the priests he did not take over, for the priests had an allotment from Pharaoh, and they lived off the allotment which Pharaoh had made to them, therefore they did not sell their land. Then he displaces all the people of Egypt from their homes. I just parenthetically, I believe that this idea of the priests not having to be part of this economic system is likely the precursor to when the B'nai Israel do become a nation of their own, and that the priests and the Levites are exempt from all of the landholding itself, actually, and from a lot of other parts of the economic system. So at this point, the basic Amcha of Mitzrayim nobody's living in their own land anymore. They don't own any of their own land anymore. And they're all avadim lefaro. They are servants to Paro. Then Yosef says to the people, whereas I have this day acquired you and your land for Paro, here's seed to sow the land. And when the harvest comes, you shall give 1/5 to Paro, and 4/5 shall be yours as seed for the fields, as food for you and those in your household, and as nourishment for your children. He didn't do vouchers. He didn't give them credit for what they gave him. He just took all their money, and then he took all of their animals, and then he took all of their land and made them slaves to Paro. I'm going to look at a couple of the commentaries on a few of these verses. First, we have source 7, which is Ramban, on the part where it says that he gathered all of the money. I just think it's interesting that Ramban really wants us to still like Yosef, although personally my patience is wearing thin. Ramban really still wants us to like Yosef. It says Yosef gathered up all of the money. He says Yosef's excellence in wisdom and understanding and knowledge. And the only reason we have to tell all of this is to show how smart Yosef was. He says, he brought all the money into Paro's house and did not accumulate for himself treasures of money and secret hiding places for the wealth of the land of Egypt or send it back home to Canaan. Instead, he gave it all the money to the king who trusted him and purchased the land for him. And this is how he found grace in the eyes of the people. For it is God who causes those who fear him to prosper. I'm just going to leave that there. Okay, then we have Rashi, who comments on town by town. The pasuk in verse 21 says, "V'et ha'am he'avir oto le'arim, mikzei gvul Mitzrayim ve'ad katzehu." The JPS translation says, he removed the population town by town. That is their translation of Le'arim, from one end of Egypt's borders to the other. Rashi is concerned about the word Le'arim. It sounds like it means to the cities. He removed the people to the cities. Sounds like he took them from their farm communities, moved them into the cities, like into the projects. But Rashi reads it a little bit differently. He reads Le'arim as by towns. He says that Yosef displaced the people in groups, taking an entire towns full of people and wholesale moving them to a different town and other towns and moving them to different towns. And Rashi is saying to us, he also wants us to like Yosef. He says there was no need for scripture to state this, except for the purpose of telling you something to Joseph's credit, that he was intending to remove a reproach from his brothers because, since the Egyptians were themselves now strangers in the cities where they dwelled, they were now not able to accuse Yosef's brothers of being strangers in Egypt. Ibn Ezra actually sees it a little bit differently. Ibn Ezra says that they were living near the capital city and that Yosef moved them to the towns near the farmland so that they could farm the fields for Paro. I read somewhere else, and I frankly don't remember where I read it, that in moving them in groups, they were displaced from their land, but they still had their social groups with them. So that's interesting, that they didn't lose their social connections, but they lost all claim on the land. They weren't, not only did they not own it anymore, but they weren't even living there. They now felt no connection to their land. So regardless of exactly how this displacement process worked, the Egyptians no longer owned land or actually anything. They didn't live in their ancestral homes, and they were slaves to Paro. Yosef has just invented feudalism, a particularly harsh version of feudalism. How do we think the Egyptians felt about this? We can see that in source number 10 in the next few psukim. And they said, "You have saved our lives. We are grateful to my Lord, and we shall be avadim to Paro." And Yosef made it into a land law in Egypt, which is still valid, that a fifth should be Paro's. Only the land of the priests did not become Paro's. So in the eyes of the narrator of the Torah. The Egyptians were so grateful to Yosef for saving their lives that they were happy to be avadim leparo, slaves to Paro. This contrasts with the next pasuk, the very next pasuk, which is source 11, which tells what happened to Bnei Israel at this moment, at the end of all the famine part. Vayeshev Yisrael be'eretz Mitzrayim be'eretz Goshen. Israel settled in the country of Egypt in the region of Goshen. Vayeachazuva vayifru vayirbu me'od. They acquired landholdings in the land of Egypt and were fertile and increased greatly. So in contrast to the actual Egyptian citizens in Egypt, Bnei Israel owned their own land. They made a lot of money and they had a lot of kids. Other than the Egyptian priests in the house of Paro himself, the only people in all of Egypt who owned land were Bnei Israel. One more mefarish on this particular section. We have source number 12, the Chizkuni, who talks about the fact that the Bnei Israel, vayifru vayirbu ma'od, they were fertile and they increased greatly. He points out that this is the fulfillment of God's promise to Yaakov. When Yaakov was leaving to come to Egypt, and he was a little concerned about leaving Canaan at that point, he stopped and made a sacrifice and prayed to God. And God addresses Yaakov at that point and says, "Fear not to go down to Egypt, for I will make you there into a great nation." And this, Vayifru Vayirbu Ma'od, where they were fruitful and multiplied, is the fulfillment of God's promise to Yaakov that they would become a great nation in Egypt. So Bnei Israel, the people of Yosef, are a great nation, a nation of resident aliens in Egypt. The Egyptians, other than the priests, are serfs, slaves to Paro, stripped of their landholdings and their earning potential. Not a great nation, an oppressed nation. The only ones in the country that were doing well were the Jews. Let's just remember one more time the covenant that we started with, the covenant with Abraham. That covenant promised Abraham the land of Canaan, but that acquisition would be preceded by being strangers, being afflicted, and being slaves. At this point in the story, Yosef has made the Egyptians strangers, Geirut, in their own land, afflicted, Inui, by not having control over their incomes and well-being, and Avadim, slaves to Paro. The tables have been turned, and the Inui, Geirut, and Avdut has now been imposed upon the Egyptians. Now, we're ready to see what happens a few generations later at the beginning of Shemot, next week's Parsha. Shemot begins with the Shemot, the recap of the names of the sons of Israel who went down to Egypt back in chapter 46 of Bereshit. And then it continues, it ends up that list by saying the total number, I'm going to show you, this is source 13, the total number of persons that were of Jacob's issue came to 70, Yosef being already in Egypt. Yosef died, and all his brothers, and all that generation, but the Bnei Israel were fertile and prolific, they multiplied and increased very greatly, so that the land was filled with them. I wondered at that point in verse 7 when it said that the land was filled with them, whether that meant that Bnei Israel had actually spread beyond the borders of Goshen and had kind of taken over the whole land of Egypt. But Ibn Ezra, which is in source 14, which I'm not going to read inside, explains that no, he thinks that that the Eretz actually just refers to the land of Goshen itself, that they hadn't actually spread out beyond that one area. Then in verse 8 it says, the famous line that we're all familiar with, Vayakom melech hadash al Mitzrayim asher lo yada et Yosef. A new king arose over Egypt who did not know Yosef. Why didn't he know Yosef? The story of how Yosef had saved the land of Egypt had faded from the history books. The gratefulness of the Egyptian people for saving their lives had worn off. Or I had a personal thought that maybe Bnei Israel was so established into tribes now that maybe like the Goshen streets and neighborhoods were named after the tribes, and that there was, you know, Reuven Street and Shimon Avenue, and that Yosef didn't actually have a tribe named after him. So maybe Yosef's name had actually faded off of the landscape, and that there was Ephraim Lane and Menasha Avenue, but that there wasn't any Yosef Street, and that maybe that's why his name was so easily forgotten. None of the commentators have anything to say about Yosef's name being forgotten at this point. Anyway, back to the sources in verse 9. Paro says to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are much too numerous for us. Let us deal shrewdly with them so that they may not increase. Otherwise, in the event of war, they may join our enemies in fighting against us and rise from the ground." The Alu Min Ha'aretz. We're going to go back to that phrase in a second. "So they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built garrison cities for Paro, Pitom and Ramses. The more they were oppressed, the more they increased and spread out, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians ruthlessly imposed upon the Israelites, Befarech, we'll look at that in a second too, the various labors that they made them perform. Ruthlessly, they made life bitter for them with harsh labor at mortar and bricks and with all sorts of tasks in the field." So in verse 10, we said, the Nilcham Banu, they will war with us, the Allah Min Ha'aretz. Paro says they might make war against the Egyptians and rise up from the land, leave the land. Wouldn't that like make the Egyptians happy? So in source 15, Rashi has an interesting explanation of this. He says that maybe the Jews would have taken such possession of the land that they would have evicted the Egyptians from the land and make the Egyptians rise up out of the land. And maybe they were just going to take over and be the residents of the land. So the Gemara in Sota, Daf Yud Aleph, page 11, which is part of which is in your source 16, that whole page of Gemara spends a lot of time analyzing this whole passage at the beginning of Shemot, implicating the Egyptians in oppressing Bnei Israel. I wanted to look at one piece of it, where it discusses verse 13, Vayavidu Mitzrayim et Bnei Israel Befarech. Now, it's translated in the JPS translation as the Egyptians ruthlessly imposed upon the Israelites. But the Gemara wants to know what the word Befarech means. Farech, which we've translated as ruthlessly or with rigor. And the Gemara says, the Egyptians made them work with rigor, befarech. This is just at the part where we turn over from 11a to 11b. Rabbi Elazar says, the word befarech is a conjugation of the words beferach, with a soft mouth, as the Egyptians enticed the Jewish people into slavery, gradually subjugating them, until they had lost their freedom completely. Kind of sounds familiar. Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani says the word befarech should be understood as with crushing, befricha, as the Egyptians subjugated Israel with back-breaking labor. We've all learned about how ruthless the Egyptians were, and things get worse after this passage as well, when Paro decrees that the baby boys should be thrown into the Nile. And Bnei Israel at that point cry out to God in their affliction, and none of that is under dispute. They were ruthless to the Jews. And let's not forget that this was all planned by God, that to become God's people and inherit the land of Canaan, Bnei Israel had to undergo strangerhood, affliction, and slavery, Geirut, Inui, and Avdut, and that this was the covenant made with Avraham all the way back at the beginning of Bereshit. Now, I don't want to talk today. I'm just going to allude briefly to the idea. It's a very difficult idea that when God wants to punish Bnei Israel, God uses another nation to do that punishment, such as the Babylonians in the time of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, or perhaps here, the Egyptians. And we wonder in some of those cases, why then, if God is actually using the Babylonians, say, as a tool for inflicting the punishment that God would like to inflict, why do the Babylonians later get punished for that? And here, why, if the Egyptians were just the tool of inflicting Inui, Avdut, and Geirut on the Bnei Israel so that they could become God's people, why are the Egyptians going to wind up punished? That is another shear for another time. It's many, many, many gallons of ink have been spilled about this topic. But in all of those cases, the sources say that the nations in question, including the Egyptians here, did have a role to play, but at some point in the process overstepped the role that God assigned them and took the affliction too far. That is particularly said here when they start killing the babies. But given the fact that God planned the Geirut, the Inui, and the Avdut, I wanted us to see a plausible explanation about how that came to pass. And here I think we have one. First, Yosef applies or inflicts all three of those things on the Egyptians themselves. He made them strangers within their own country. He stripped them of their belongings and made them slaves to Paro. Bnei Israel, in contrast, owned land within the land of Egypt and became wealthy and secure. They were not one small bloodline. They were 12 semi-independent bloodlines united into one powerful nation, living on their land, while the Egyptians were not living on their own land in their ancestral homes. It begins to sound reasonable that a new generation, perhaps unaware that things could have been much worse if Yosef hadn't saved their lives with his economic planning, that this new generation would feel threatened by this powerful set of resident aliens. To conclude, I want to bring you two brief passages about the downstream effects of Yosef's actions. As Sefer Shemot continues, of course, Moshe is appointed the leader to bring Bnei Israel out of slavery. Moshe is the Redeemer as God's servant. Rabbi Aryeh Klapper has a fascinating comparison of Moshe as leader to Yosef as leader and the actions that he took that we just analyzed. This is your source 17, and I'm going to read it out loud. To sum up, said Rabbi Klapper, Yosef seems not to question his moral context, not to wonder whether the power in a society is necessarily doing that which is right. Thus, a former slave places all Egypt in slavery. Perhaps the sages are making this point when they censure Joseph for relying on the cupbearer rather than on God to rescue him from Potiphar's jail. As an arbitrary prisoner, he had a clear chance to recognize the corruption of Egyptian society. But instead, he worked the system. Moshe Rabbeinu provides the perfect contrast. Moshe, raised by the Egyptian monarchy, has a sudden epiphany in which he realizes the corruption of the system and rejects all the advantages it brings him. Yosef is the Jew who loses himself in the Egyptian moral context. Moshe is the Jew who finds himself by recognizing its corruption. Thus, Moshe Rabbeinu is Yosef's personal redeemer. And finally, when Bnei Israel are redeemed from slavery in Egypt, we know that they had to be entirely dependent upon God as they wandered without land holdings and without their own sources of food in the desert for 40 years. Micha Odenheimer, in an essay for 929, which I found on Safaria, talks about the man, the manna, the God-given food, as a kind of tikkun, as a reparation for Yosef's actions during the years of plenty and the years of famine. And this is your source 18. Redemption, along with the giving of the Torah, says Micha Odenheimer, is marked by a new means of sustenance. The Israelites are lifted out of the, by now, seemingly inevitable economy and culture of hoarding through the story of the man. The sages rightly saw the man as creating a preparatory material basis for divine revelation. The Torah was not given, says the Talmud, but to the eaters of the man. What is the essential quality of man? It is a sustenance unmediated by a human economic system. It cannot be stored or hoarded. The manna itself creates a new kind of economy. One where it's harder to oppress anyone because everyone is equal and gets just what they need. So where does this leave us? Bnei Israel go on to become God's own nation and to inherit the land of Canaan as God promised Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Yosef himself. They even go on to reform the institution of slavery, imposing strict limits on how slaves could be treated. I just think it's interesting to note that not all of our Torah heroes were so heroic, and not all of our adversaries were as unprovoked as we might think. That God's promise is fulfilled, but there actually has to be a coherent story of how all that comes to pass. And that's what we see in the final chapters of Bereshit and the first chapters of Shemot. No one is all good or all bad, not Yaakov, not Yosef, certainly not his brothers, not even the Egyptians, and not me, and not you. We are all participating in the next chapters of the history of Bnei Israel. We have the potential to learn from these stories in the Torah and create a more just society. We can replace hoarding with man. We can notice oppression around us and try to fix it. And we can be God's chosen nation in a way that is worthy of God. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions, comments? Okay, thank you very much. Very, very interesting. And yes, the idea that Yosef set the stage for the slavery of the Jewish people, unbeknownst to him, is, of course, very true, but very sad and tragic, you know, at the same time. But you say the complexity of all the stories, but thank you. Okay, any comments, questions? No? Okay, well, all right, everybody was left breathless. Okay, I don't know what to say. Usually, you know, yeah.
I am left breathless. Quite an amazing
share. Okay, all right. Anybody?
I heard somebody say they have a question.
Yeah, Vakasha.
Do you louder?
Gershon, a little louder. We can barely hear you.
Do you think that the Torah's text description of Yosef is positive or negative? And this is, and do, and if. Whichever, do you agree that it's debatable?
I feel like the facts make me very angry with Yosef, but the Torah, the narrative voice of the Torah praises Yosef. So I find it very conflicting.
It's interesting why, you know, Yosef is known by our sages as Yosef HaTzadik, yeah. Of all people. It's not just they find him positive, he's... So now you could say that's because of Potiphar or that. I mean, there are many, you can be, or I actually wrote this once in the Dvar Torah. I was looking at Yosef. Yosef is maybe a tzaddik in the definition of the Rambam, that if you're 51% mitzvah and 49%, that's how the Rambam defines a tzaddik, just over 50% plus one in Hilchot Teshuvah. So,
kind of a brisker way of looking at Yosef.
Right. I know that's too lamdish. I agree. When I think Chazal say it's a tzaddik, but I think it could be like he had no choice and he didn't realize. In other words, the Torah, even, you know, he meant good, perhaps. I agree it is very harsh the way he treated, you know, he took everybody's property, but, I don't know, maybe he didn't have a choice. And whatever, history, you know, came out and he was God's messenger, in a sense, to provide for the Jewish people to slave. But you're right, it is interesting.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
Malcolm Avakasha, yes.
It's interesting that all the things that Yosef did benefited Paro. And if you look at the Psukim, it says, Vayakam melech hadash asher liyada es Yosef. He forgot all the things that Yosef did. So you would think that all these issues would have come from the people, but it seems like it's come from Paro, who's the one person who should have been grateful for Yosef for what he did for him.
Yeah. He, in fact, was the one who wasn't oppressed.
Yeah, exactly. He got the benefit of all this. He became enriched. So it's kind of interesting or... You would have expected it was the people rising up versus Paro.
So you're saying you think that leaders should be aware of history?
No, I'm saying that the leader, he was the one who should have been grateful to Yosef, and he was the one who initiated all the slavery against the people, because Yosef, what Yosef did benefited him, didn't benefit the people, but Paro was enriched by it, yet he was the one who initiated all the slavery. He was the one who addressed his people and said, Havin Schachma.
Yeah, I think we see a long, long history of leaders not paying much attention to history, even when it has benefited them. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
That's what politicians do sometimes when they're of no benefit. I mean, that's really a story. Yosef, you don't hear from him in the last 54 years of his life. He has no power. When he dies, he can't get buried in Israel. He doesn't have any power anymore. You know, he for sure it's that whether it's a new paro in Shemot or not, you know, the famous debate.
Right.
But this paro for sure, sidelined him. What happened after the famine's over? That's it. You never hear from Yosef again until he dies.
So I wonder if that's related to the fact that he doesn't get a tribe named after him.
I don't know why it'd be connected. What is Parano from tribes? Like, I don't know that. I don't know. But I'm just saying, like, even within Vayechi, basically they bury their father. They come back. The brothers, they have that very sad interaction. The brothers think he's going to take revenge. And then you don't hear anything. You hear that he raised his great-grandchildren. Menashe's grandchildren played on his lap. And then he died at 110, and they buried him in Egypt. And he says, you know what, please, when I die, when you leave Egypt, take my body from me because I can't go now. He was sidelined totally in his life. And you didn't have to wait at all. Anyway. Okay. Another cons. Well, thank everybody. And my share tomorrow morning, 9:15. Those who want to get up early, in Toronto, the fast starts at 6:39. It's Zarba Teva tomorrow, you know, Friday fast day. And anyway, so I want to, but my share 9:15, Rabbi Liebtag, of course, Sunday at 11:15. Next week, Zev Elif and Shuli Mishkin will be starting their series. I think those are the two new series starting, Adventures in American Jewish History. And of course, Shuli on Life in Talmudic time, so to speak, the reality, always fascinating stuff, both ancient and modern, right? And then all our regular classes during the week. So, look forward to learning with you. And as I say, payment, that's the new, for 2025, we charge everybody to come to this class. They have to invite one friend who doesn't come to Torah Motion. You have to let one person know about it and invite them. That's the price of admission. I don't have any guards at the door, but that's if you could spread the word, that's always our best form of advertising, letting people know about the classes. So I want to wish everybody well, Shabbat Shalom, and we'll see you soon. And thank you very much, Dr. Hornstein. Very, very, very interesting and much to think about. Okay. Laila Tov, everybody. Shabbat Shalom. Be well.
Shabbat Shalom.
Yasher Koach. Shabbat Shalom.
Bye-bye. Shabbat Shalom.